Welcome to Partners in Justice, a podcast from the Center for American and International Law. We deliver in-depth discussions about the rule of law and improving the quality of justice with leaders and experts from the legal and law enforcement communities.
Hello, I'm T.L. Cubbage. I'm president of the Center for American and International Law, an organization founded in 1947 by one of the leading American prosecutors at the first of the Nuremberg war crime trials after World War II. CAIL, the Center for American and International Law, is dedicated to promoting the rule of law through education. Today, I'm speaking with Jonathan Bush, who teaches law, including courses on war crimes and international law at Columbia University School of Law. Professor Bush holds degrees from Princeton, Oxford, and Yale, and is joining us, I'm glad to say, while on spring break. And I appreciate his time with us together. Welcome, Professor Bush.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you. And it's a real honor to speak at the institution founded by Colonel Story, whose memos and letters from Nuremberg I've often studied.
Our topic today is promoting the rule of law, Nuremberg and wars of aggression. Specifically, in light of current events in Ukraine, there's been a great deal of interest in how law can be a tool to address, deter, and/or hold accountable those responsible for crimes in the context of war. Now, many people are aware that the Nuremberg trial addressed crimes in the nature of atrocities and genocide. But today we'd like to focus on a particular and somewhat different aspect of that trial and of international law. And that is the crime against peace, as it was put before the Nuremberg Tribunal. So for today's discussion, we will focus not on atrocities and genocide and wrongful acts under law in the context of war, but specifically focus on when international law deems it a crime and will hold individuals accountable for being instigators of a war. Now, Professor, I remember from a history book learning about a French king who wrote on his cannons that they were the final argument of kings. And there seemed to be that notion reflect the idea of, well, sovereigns just have the right to go to war against each other. Certainly that's not true anymore. But why is it that the ability is to declare war on another state, how did it come to be that that was regarded as not a legitimate prerogative of a sovereign state?
I think the answer lies after World War I, not World War II. There was such widespread revulsion at the slaughter in the trenches and so on, and at a war that seemed senseless and just had seemed to start of its own accord, that our President Wilson tried to negotiate a League of Nations. We had senators in the interwar period who were lobbying for making the outlawry of war, that anyone who makes war should be treated like the old medieval outlaw. And there were petitions with millions of people in this country, and we weren't even part of the League of Nations system. There was an interwar treaty between the U.S. and France that purported to forswear war as an instrument of war. It wasn't a criminal treaty, and it didn't provide for any mechanisms, and it didn't define what aggression was either. But it was part of this process, and it was heavily relied on at Nuremberg. But toward the end of World War II, there was already this sort of interwar body of law, which was strengthened. I mean, we tried to outlaw war, and now look how it came back even more forcefully and more dreadfully. And so it was that those who planned Nuremberg, and ironically, much of what was Nuremberg was planned in the Pentagon by civilian lawyers who were senior staff, legal advisors, colonels. And one of them, I think in particular, gets the credit, but he proposed and President Roosevelt accepted that this should be part of any American plan, punishing people for making the war in the first place. And over the negotiations that in the summer of 1945 for Nuremberg, that came to be, that the crime of aggression is is one of the principal crimes that was charged at Nuremberg.
Now, Nuremberg was not a unilateral United States initiative, was it?
No, and I shouldn't give that impression. Nuremberg was the four victors, the Soviet Union, as it was, Britain, U.S., and because we sort of operated in a mental universe that said that, of course, France is a great power, even though it had been defeated, France was immediately readmitted to the world of great power. So Nuremberg had four prosecuting authorities, and France was there in part to represent and to speak for the atrocities and the aggression done against the Western countries, Denmark, Netherlands, Belgium, and so on. And the Soviet Union took on the same role with respect to the Eastern European countries, principally Poland. And there were also Polish and Dutch and Danish lawyers, the Czech lawyers at Nuremberg helping.
Let's set the stage a little further about Nuremberg specifically. You've mentioned that the countries that participated, of course, in historical memory and popular imagination, typically Hitler is thought of as being most responsible for the Nazi war crimes. But by the time the Nuremberg Tribunal assembled, Hitler was dead. So who was on trial at Nuremberg before the International Tribunal?
24 people were indicted. One of them was deemed non compos, Krupp, the head of the Krupp arms empire. And so he was severed. So 23, and one of them committed suicide. So we're down to 22. There were also six organizations in a theory that the Tokyo Tribunal didn't follow soon after, and that none of the recent tribunals have followed because the Europeans do not accept the common law theory that a corporate entity can commit a crime. And Germany says it just can't be. I'm sorry. So to this day, the International Criminal Court does not look at organizational guilt. But Nuremberg had, in the end, 22 organizations, 22 individuals, and six organizations, the SS, the Reich Cabinet, the senior leadership of the Nazi Party, the German military high command, and so on. The lead individual defendant was Goering, Field Marshal Goering, who was at various times Hitler's number two, the head of the Air Force. Other prominent people included Martin Bormann, who was sort of the head of the administrative apparatus, Rudolf Hess, who had been Hitler's previous party head and had fled to England in the middle of the war, two field marshals, two grand admirals, including one who had succeeded Hitler for the last week after the suicide, Dönitz and Admiral Raeder, and then various senior people from other entities. I mean, the head of the senior surviving person from the SS was there, foreign ministry people, two foreign ministers, and so on. They were all, at that point, they all would have been nationally known. They would have been known throughout the world. They'd been, almost all of them would have been in the news for 20 years already. It would have been literally like naming Putin. They were all household names.
Right. But they went beyond, say, just the leader, as in the case of Putin, but members of the cabinet and also members of what you might call those who were accessories to the operations of the government. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And you can go even farther that, you know, at the end of the first trial, for various reasons, it was decided to have a second round of trials. And the best known, in the end, the United States had 12 and France had one. And the best known of them is the doctor's trial of the doctors and medical officials who had organized euthanasia and medical human experimentation and so on. Another is the justice case, the one that tried, the one that's fictionalized in Judgment at Nuremberg, the Hollywood movie. But the point is that those cases were very clearly defined almost by sector. You know, prosecutors said, look, for judicial convenience, we're going to try all the doctors at once. We don't have an unlimited lifespan here as a court. We'll have one for the judges. We'll have one for the medical officials, and there were a number for economic and military leaders, and so on. But that program underscores what the first Nuremberg trial did, which was try and address this enormous state apparatus by sector. I mean, that's the way to think of it. It's there are people who do military, who are military participants. There are foreign ministry people. And I don't want to jump to making comparisons, but nobody would say if we if there was a trial now of Russia, nobody would say that it's Putin alone. He has Lavrov, he has generals, he has all sorts of people. And that's the sort of apparatus that a modern state uses to commit mass atrocities or to start wars.
Well, so what was, could you describe what was the charge or the charges that were brought against the senior defendants at the first of the tribunal trials, those high-level individuals and those organizations you mentioned? What were the charges or the counts of the indictment against them?
Count two, if you don't mind my doing it out of order, is planning, preparing, initiating, and waging an aggressive war. I'm sort of tracking the language of the indictment. The other counts are traditional war crimes and crimes against humanity. And count one was a conspiracy charge, which again was an American impetus, came at our impetus, and the British had no problem because they have conspiracy law in their system as well. And as with other features, as with corporate liability, the continent doesn't know it, but they allowed us. And count one was Justice Jackson's notion of the plan to do everything, to make the war, to ethnically cleanse and kill entire races, to enslave a continent and so on. But it was initially to be the planning the war and planning the atrocities. So conspiracy, aggression, war crimes, crimes against humanity.
As I said at the outset, I'd like to focus on this idea of the crime against peace, the crime of instigating the unprovoked war. One of the things about the indictment is it addressed the German leadership's pretext, because when Germany invaded Poland in 1939, isn't it correct that they made up a story to supposedly justify their aggression?
For each of the early acts, there was a pretext. Obviously, when Hitler demanded satisfaction, which meant territorial concessions from Czechoslovakia, it was to protect the Sudeten Germans from terrible persecutions that the state of Czechoslovakia was doing to them. It wasn't doing anything, of course, but that was the allegation. And then when it was Poland's turn soon after, the allegation was that a bunch of Poles had tried to start a war by invading German territory, which turned out to be a bunch of prisoners who were dressed up in Polish army uniforms and shot. Prisoners that were in German custody. So it was a complete, and that was such a thin pretext that I think they dropped it very quickly, the idea that Poland is trying to invade Germany. Look. And we just happen to have a huge number, hundreds of thousands of troops mobilized on the border, ready to go in response to this two dozen dead bodies. I mean, it's as, again, without jumping to conclusions, it's as ridiculous as saying that the 190,000 odd troops that Putin had massed in Russia and Belarus were there because of, a misfired couple of shells from Ukrainian forces.
And the indictment specifically held charge these individuals, these leaders of members of the cabinet, the leaders of the military, with being accountable for actively participating in that conspiracy to launch unprovoked, unjustified aggression. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And it went farther. It went not just the high-level military people, but also sort of the chief of the Minister of Economics, Schacht, was charged in effect with having planned guns and butter without tax hikes and by having done the books so cleverly that for a while other countries didn't see the massive violations of the Treaty of Versailles. So guns and butter and hiding it all. So he was charged with part of the aggression as well, with planning. For better or worse, I should say, he was acquitted. I don't think there's any doubt about what he did. And it's really on a matter of law. And it's a devastating matter of law. We have diary accounts that recall looking at Justice Jackson on October 1st, 1946, as he sat at the prosecutor's table and the judges were reading their judgment, and they get to Schacht and acquit him. And apparently Jackson's is crestfallen, knowing that this means that crimes against peace, whatever else it will be, can never be applied under Nuremberg theories to economic planners and other sort of nonviolent planners of war.
I don't want to delve too much into the biographies of the personalities, but you mentioned Justice Robert Jackson for the United States, and I think it might be useful just to spend a moment to identify more Justice Jackson and the role he played in this very important institution.
Well, I'll answer it in two ways. One is he was critically important, and he was one of four co-equal chief prosecutors. Like Soviet Union, Britain, and France all had chiefs. I was reminded of that, and I'm forever humble. In the mid-90s, I had the good fortune for my research to have an interview with the surviving British chief prosecutor, and Lord Shawcross, Hartley Shawcross, who was in his 90s then and long retired. And it was one of those things where as I was driving to his house, remember, he was the chief. He was the chief. He was co-equal. And when you tell yourself over and over, don't say X, it came out wrong. And I looked at him and said, well, of course, Justice Jackson, the chief. And he looked at me with this thick, plummy British accent, said, he was not the chief prosecutor. He was the chief American prosecutor. Bob was my co-equal. And, you know, and I just slunk lower and lower and slid down my chair until I think I was on the floor. But so I always remember there were four co-equal chiefs, all of them, even the Russian judge who was the Russian prosecutor gave very eloquent opening arguments and so on. But having said that, Jackson in many ways was the first among equals, partly because he had a more complete mandate than the others. Shawcross was still a sitting member of the British government and had governmental responsibilities in London. The French went through a series of chief prosecutors as their governments were roiling. And the Russian Soviet chief prosecutor was under a very short leash from Moscow, as a recent book has shown us, the way that Moscow kept a close eye. And it became sort of an American joke at one party, apparently a social party. I think it was the Russians. The Russian chief prosecutor gave Jackson a wristwatch as a sign of respect. And he said something like, this is the first time the Russians given me the time of day, because everyone knew if you asked the Russian delegates a question, the representatives, the answer was always the same. We'll get back to you soon. We have to ask Moscow. And Jackson had an executive order by Harry Truman saying, you're the boss, take care of it. So Jackson didn't really have to check in with anyone. And the other reason, of course, is that Jackson represented the only country that hadn't been bombed heavily or occupied of the Nuremberg chiefs. We had the money. Nuremberg was in the American zone. We rebuilt the courthouse. We stocked it with the translators, guards, all this, the ancillary staff. And so it was sort of, you know, they were playing on our court with our money. So in a way, Jackson was, he didn't always get his way. And sometimes when he did, he shouldn't have. He made the mistakes, as we all do, in trial strategy. But he was the chief U.S. prosecutor. He was coming straight from the Supreme Court, where he had been for, half dozen years. And before that, had been attorney general, briefly solicitor general. He was a New Deal lawyer who had a remarkable rise to the top and had a remarkable power of eloquence.
So let's talk for a moment about the Soviet Union, because it's my understanding that with respect to charging the German leaders with crime against peace, the Soviets weren't a reluctant partner, but in fact, some Soviet thinkers made strong encouragements and contributions to that charge. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I mean, there were Soviet theorists who had written during the war, and those one theorist in particular was part of the planning session for Nuremberg. I think that same book that I alluded to, the recent work by a scholar who rightly shows the Soviet role at the trial, I think it exaggerates greatly their importance in planning the trial. I think it was almost entirely an American idea that the Soviets had been writing about fascist aggression and Nazi this. They were using, I think, in a rhetorical way, not in a legal way. And many of the American negotiators and British negotiators in planning Nuremberg were already skeptical of Soviet legality. The Vyshinsky, who came to visit the Nuremberg trial, I think twice, but Vyshinsky was well known for having presided at the show trials in the late 30s. And while those may have caused agonies of indecision for a few leftists who didn't see what Stalin was doing, Western leftists, people like Jackson saw very well that these are really, you know, we have to play with them. They did the bulk of the fighting and the dying. They are our indispensable allies, but they don't understand law as we understand law. They did talk about Hitlerite criminality and aggression. I don't think that's what these planners in our War Department that convinced Roosevelt and convinced Jackson and Truman and all the rest, I don't think they meant the same thing. You can see it if you want in the definition of the charge for of aggression at Nuremberg. In the summer, when they were negotiating, what are the laws here we're going to apply? Jackson, who was a forceful but often not effective negotiator, and whose tactic in negotiations was often, well, I'm going to leave. I'm just going to quit. The hell with you. We're going to do it alone. And he had to be talked down off that ledge a few times by the Secretary of State. But to his eternal credit, when they defined the definition, he said, the definition of crimes against peace has to be a clean definition. It can't say Nazi violations or German or Axis power. It has to say anyone who does this. And that this is either waging, planning, initiating, or a war in violation of treaties. The Soviets insisted that for them to participate, their minimum was that the whole court could only hear crimes done by the Axis powers. But the definition itself, Jackson used a famous phrase, which I'll now mangle about, we can't force the defendants to drink from a poisoned chalice lest we someday be forced to sip from it. And he insisted on a clean, purely legal definition of all three crimes. And that's how it read.
And so in terms of accountability for these defendants who were charged with crimes, including crime against peace, by instigating and being part of a conspiracy to instigate a war of aggression, what were the consequences? Who was held accountable and how?
Well, 18 are convicted, 3 are acquitted, including the Minister of Economics that we've mentioned. Of those convicted, almost all are convicted for aggression, among other things. Some of them are also for crimes against humanity and war crimes. I mean, for instance, Admiral Dönitz, the head of the submarine fleet, and then the last head of the Third Reich, Dönitz was too junior to be part of planning and preparing. So he wasn't convicted of that, but he was convicted of waging an aggressive war by virtue of his leading the submarine forces. He wasn't convicted of crimes against humanity because they didn't do many crimes against humanity from a submarine, but he was convicted of war crimes for various tactics that his submarines used against sailors and sunken ships and in lifeboats. But most people were convicted of crimes against peace, aggression, and many were executed. My number should be better, but it's about a dozen were executed and a dozen weren't. That doesn't add up to 18, but we can find out later. And of those, most were held for a while. Some were given early release. Admiral Rader was an ill man and was given early release. Speer was given a full 20 years served every day of it. And Martin Bormann was given a life sentence and controversially served every day of that. So there was accountability. If I could just tell the second half of the story, which is we did much the same thing at Tokyo, in the Tokyo tribunals, which had a very similar charter modeled on the Nuremberg charter with a few tweaks. And there too, almost everybody is convicted. It emphasized crimes against peace, war, you know, aggression even more strongly, because the theory was the Japanese leaders tried there, could be tried with war crimes and crimes against humanity, and many were. But to be in that first major trial, they had to be part of the crimes against peace. And they were, and most were convicted. And even in the later 13 trials, the 12 American and one French, there are convictions for crimes against peace. But it gets fewer and fewer. And the American trials later narrow the law. They basically say military people alone can't be guilty of crimes against peace unless they have what we'd call political authority to say, go, invade. So the German high command, the half dozen officials tried in the last American trial at Nuremberg, are acquitted as a matter of law. The court says, you know, if it were like, if they were generals like Franco, if they had generals who had political authority, we could hear the case. But a general who only follows orders, if you want, who doesn't have the political authority, cannot be guilty. So there is a narrowing. First, the economics people are out, then the military people, however high, we're talking about five stars, field marshals, they're acquitted of that charge. And what's left are political leaders and foreign policy leaders, diplomats.
And to be clear, to be sure, though, to say that the military leaders are going to be excluded from guilt for starting the war, that, of course, does not mean they're at all exonerated from crimes of atrocity or genocide and so forth within the war that has begun.
Absolutely. And these later trials, you know, I think can be, this isn't a sufficient explanation. We're lawyers and you don't dismiss a judgment by saying, oh, it's the context. But it is true that when these later, this trial I'm referring to is issued in late 1948, there really have been a diminishing appetite for trials and a real fatigue about trials. And at the two truly international trials, the first Nuremberg trial and Tokyo, there are lots of military people convicted who did not have political rank as well, convicted of crimes against peace, of aggression. Absolutely.
I'd like to turn now to how this precedent, as you said, it had its origins and discussions even before World War II, but firmly established, quite dramatically established at Nuremberg. How has this principle of criminalizing war of aggression played out after the Nuremberg trials in the 1940s?
Well, it's the incredible shrinking liability program, if you want, because the famous words of the first Nuremberg Tribunal was to describe when they turned to discussing what they were about to rule with individuals for in general about aggression. They said aggression is the supreme crime. And that's the famous phrase. It makes all the other crimes possible. That's how these war crimes happen, because somebody starts a war and controls some territory and does things. So in 1946, you wouldn't find any argument saying it's the supreme crime. And indeed, it might well be viewed that, you know, the others can be handled by national courts. I mean, Poland tried the two successive commandants of Auschwitz under just Polish domestic law. Israel later on would try Eichmann. I mean, you can try very senior mass killers in a national court and have a reasonably fair proceeding. Poland was not fully communist at the time of these trials, but it was heavily, heavily influenced by Soviet troops that were there. But there were Western observers, and, you know, these were massively guilty people who had fair trials and then were punished, executed. So you can have a national trial, for mass atrocities. But aggression is such a special crime that it seems, particularly in a broad spillover war, to require some international response. And that partly answers your question, because we had the Cold War. On one hand, there were UN committees and international law committees that for many years were working on new, improved, refined definitions of aggression. On the other hand, you had an international mechanism and a political constellation that was firmly frozen and divided, and that anything that one side said that looked like it might threaten the other was going nowhere. I once spent some time looking for little straws in the wind, looking for how was it mentioned at all, let's say in the 40s and 50s. And I found that, for instance, the Soviet Union was insisting that the U.S. was committing legal aggression by sponsoring Radio Free Europe and other broadcasting, that if you don't have to send troops over, you're planning, you're getting people all riled up, you're starting maybe a resistance movement. And they renewed these calls after the Hungarian Revolution in 56. So people are saying that's aggression. It turns out that at the time of Suez, you find both of the two successive British prosecutors at Nuremberg, Lord Shawcross and his deputy, Lord Kilmuir, Maxwell Fyfe. Both of them were in the House of Lords. They're on different sides of Suez, of whether the Brits should have gone in. And they're both, of course, saying, well, this is aggression. What's aggression? Well, one side said, what Nasser just did is an act of aggression, and we went in to stop it. And the other, Shawcross, is saying, nonsense. What we're doing could potentially be viewed as aggression. So it becomes a political football occasionally, but most times it's totally forgotten because of the Cold War. I think there are a couple of obscure national cases where the Poles and the Yugoslavs found defendants, high level Nazis, and threw an account of you were part of Hitlerite aggression and you committed atrocities here. But these cases are so obscure that they're not part of the international canon. They were done by, a Stalinist creature legal system, and nobody takes them seriously. So as for the legal talk that people did take seriously, it went nowhere. It was done by in the halls of the UN and ignored, or it was done in the streets of democracies at the time of Vietnam, as both sides were saying, who's the aggressor?
Let me ask you about a pretty clear, at least in my mind, case of naked aggression 30 years ago when Iraq invaded and promptly conquered Kuwait, its neighbor. And I don't remember if there was a pretext from the Saddam Hussein at that time, but it was pretty self-evidently a naked act of aggression to grab the Kuwaiti oil fields. How did the international arena respond to that? And did it respond? Obviously, there was military response, but was there a legal aspect of that response?
Yes, and I think it's a great question in two ways. One, because it does show, again, that, Jackson's famous phrase at Nuremberg was hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. And, there's always an excuse. And Iraq's excuse, as I recall, was that Kuwait is not a legitimate country. It's only there because of British-French line drawing after World War I. And it's really our lost 19th province, and we're reclaiming it. And if that sounds like something people in Taiwan are worried about, they should. And so there was an excuse. But on the more important point, we talked about a criminal aggression during the Cold War and how it went nowhere. But there's also the international law perspective, which is the UN Charter was deemed to be the starting point and the highest authority. Article 2 forbids force. Every country is sovereign and should be kept safe, with the exception of Article 51, self-defense. And, well, who decides in a world where everybody calls the other an aggressor? The theory is, well, the UN will decide. And when Iraq did this, we were able to go to the UN and get a UN mandate. Again, could it have been vetoed? Sure. It had to come through the Security Council to authorize force. That can't be done by the General Assembly majority vote. And that means that the rump, I'm trying to get my years right, I think it was Russia then in 1990, not the Soviet Union, but whatever the legal entity was that had the old Soviet Union's veto seat, did not veto this, and neither did China. And so the U.S. was able to get an international force with a broad coalition and enforce the UN Charter deemed, which the UN process had deemed this aggression. So it wasn't a criminal law determination that, yes, he's an aggressor, or here are the, and there was consequently no need to find out, well, who else, which foreign minister, which which other senior planners were part of it, because we weren't making a criminal decision. We were making this UN international law decision. And on the basis of that, we were able to rally an international force against an aggressor.
But to be clear, that was then a response by nations of the world against the state of Iraq, and not and successfully in that case to repel the aggression, but not to hold individuals accountable.
That's right. But it wasn't just General Schwarzkopf's forces and Colin Powell's political coalition. It was also because there had been a mandate to undo Iraq's aggression, we were able to say, we meaning not just the U.S., but the allies were able to impose on Iraq the continuing obligation to pay reparations to the victims. And there was this huge fund, which, again, there was most shattered, losing powers don't have the resources, but Iraq sits on oil. So we said a percentage of the oil will go to the reparations fund. And I forget, it was within the last few months, the fund finally said all claimants have been paid. We're closing business. We're shutting up business. The 1990 aggression has finally been resolved fully legally. But all sorts of claimants, ranging from oil companies to the nation of Kuwait to individual property owners in Kuwait, got compensation through a very careful process. So that was the final legal end of that war.
As an aside, that body, the United States or United Nations Claims Commission, if I recall the name correctly, in Geneva, many people who have become active participants in Cale's Institute for Transnational Arbitration spent parts of their careers on the staff administering or adjudicating those claims to give reparation to various victims of the aggression against Kuwait. So I know it does not include me, but a number of my friends spent time in Geneva working on those, on that international process to make amends using Iraqi resources to the victims of its aggression in Kuwait. So just an interesting aside. I'm familiar with that institution largely because of that. Obviously, in the case of the UN and that using the UN Charter for a international law response, it had to go through the Security Council. So that does highlight a vulnerability of that process, does it not?
It does. Boy, does it ever. You know, sometime around, in the 90s, I think with two new tribunals and a successful resolution, it was felt to Iraq, two new criminal tribunals for Rwanda and Bosnia, former Yugoslavia. Many people in my field were feeling pretty good that we now have legal mechanisms that can handle aggression and war. And the culmination to them was the creation in 1998, and then 2000, enough nations had ratified it, of an international criminal court. So now you had everything. You had a court between nations that could make determinations of genocide and so on. You know, has a country done it? You had a criminal court that could hear cases against individuals. And you had a Security Council that apparently could get beyond Cold War gridlock. And many of them, people wiser than me, still think that can be done. And, I see all sorts of speakers now, urging there be trials now for Putin and so on. And my view is just my two cents. But I think this is a very dark time. We've shown that international institutions are deeply flawed, and when done by a great power, can be completely handcuffed. And for anyone who thinks that, talk about, well, this is the easiest case I've ever seen. It may be. Short of World War II, this may be the easiest case of aggression that you'll ever see. But the ICC opened up an investigation many years ago into the 2008 Russian violations in Georgia. And that case is, they're still working on that. And it really, I was reminded of that in the last few days, just thinking that, I mean, that's 13 years for what now seems clearly to have been just an earlier iteration of this. They didn't commit as many atrocities as in Chechnya or Syria or now Ukraine, because it was easier to overwhelm Georgia quickly and seize what they wanted. But if such an easy case of aggression is still under investigation, it's a powerful cautionary, I think, to those who think, well, just give it to the ICC, clear case, we have prosecutors on staff, we'll hear from you in a few weeks, right? Wrong.
Let me ask a little more about the ICC, or the International Criminal Court, established by treaty. Does it codify that a war of aggression is an offense within the jurisdiction of that tribunal?
Yes, but, and let me explain the yes and then the but. When the court was first set up by a 1998 agreement, it has this very funny language of jurisdiction that basically says the court should be able to hear grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and such other crimes as may from time to time be added to its jurisdictions by consent, including at a time not less than 20 years from now, aggression. Boy, that's a weird one. And it was there because what was already a fledgling court, it was felt aggression is the ultimate hot potato. And let's give the court some time to have a track record and consensus, you know, some buy-in and support. And then we can address this question. And maybe by then we'll even get an acceptable definition of aggression legally. And in 2018, that happened after years of negotiation. 2018 was 20 years after the treaty. And meeting in Kampala, negotiators of countries that were participating in the ICC system agreed, now it's time, here's a definition, it is now officially added to the jurisdiction for countries that agree to the addition. So something like 120 countries are participants in the ICC system, excuse my rough numbers, but I think it's only like in the mid-40s countries that are agreed to have aggression as jurisdiction that they will acknowledge. Russia does not participate in the ICC or its or the aggression add-on. Neither does the U.S. And in fact, neither do most of the largest countries of the world. So it is true, as proponents of the ICC say quite rightly, that most countries in the world participate. But that doesn't include most of the larger countries, not India, not Pakistan, not the U.S., not Indonesia, I believe, not Russia, not China. I think Brazil is the largest of the 10 largest countries that does participate. So it's very uneven. I mean, clearly, there's a lot of skepticism among the great powers. Our NATO allies, without exception, do participate.
So the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or perhaps you might say the renewed or expanded invasion of Ukraine, is being met by a broad range of multilateral responses, including economic sanctions and various measures to support the Ukrainian government. But what does the example and precedent of Nuremberg suggest is at least a possible or hypothetical response to that aggression?
Well, the hypothetical would go something like this. The ICC chief prosecutor has already announced that he is, at the urging of many participant countries, he's ready to throw himself into it and open an investigation. And he will. I'm sure he has. They have a very large staff, I think. There's staff of something like 900. They have other investigations proceeding, but they have, you know, big staff. And he has the mandate to do this. But what are you going to do when you know, he can't even get probably documents saying Putin did this on a certain day. Putin gave this order to a senior deputy. I mean, I think his investigation. Let me go back and tell a sad story. During World War II, as in the late part of the war, as countries started to think about war crimes accountability, they were set up an entity called the UN War Crimes Commission. It's not the modern UN. It was the Allies had taken to calling themselves the United Nations United because we're fighting against the Axis. But it's pre-San Francisco, pre-charter, pre-UN. So here's this organization with about 15 countries, the US, Britain, and mainly the occupied nations of Europe. China was a member, but China didn't come to the European meetings because the delegate couldn't get there in a wartime. And the mission was to think of legal theories and prepare cases. And at the end of the war, it was clear to prosecutors who worked to the, you know, for the new Nuremberg project, going to the UN War Crimes Commission and saying, so what do you got? Give us the cases that you have ready to go. We can do something now. We have prosecutions. And they, without exception, said they really have nothing. They have stories of people who paddled over from Belgium across the English Channel in the war saying, I don't know, there was this unit, 20 men. They rounded up all the villagers. They shot all the men. I don't know. There was someone called Hans. I mean, they were trivial, low-level retail cases in the main. And as for the legal theories, there's a famous moment in the spring of 45 when the head of this UN War Crimes Commission was asked in a press conference, so what theories have you developed that might allow for the trial of Hitler? And he said, and then this was no newcomer to the field. He had been head of the Permanent Court of International Justice. He was the leading British authority, Sir Cecil Hurst. And he said, that's going a little bit too far. We don't really have any theory that will allow us to charge Hitler. And at that point, you could see the world and certainly the prosecutors shrugging and saying, you have nothing to offer. And my fear is that the ICC can come that close, but not closer. Because how do all these things work? Someone investigates, gathers evidence. It maybe helps to rally an international consensus that a country or individuals or leaders are doing the act. And then we wait for something, a coup, the failure of their effort. I mean, Saddam Hussein fell. Others fall. That's what we wait for. And then, from Sudan, from here or there. Otherwise, all we have is the possibility of an in absentia proceeding. If you don't have Charles Taylor from Liberia or Saddam Hussein or someone else whom you've been investigating, all you have is some evidence, maybe not enough for a court, for a trial. And, you're faced with, do we go forth in a criminal way without the defendant and without full evidence, which is what the Lebanon Tribunal did, the one that was set up by the UN to investigate the murder of Prime Minister Hariri, and where all the Hezbollah suspects just said, the hell with you, we're not appearing, we're not cooperating. Well, we've had a high-paid staff in Paris gathering evidence, but none of it conclusive for a proceeding that can't go any farther. Or you do have something like Nuremberg, where Martin Bormann was tried in absentia, but where there was a mountain, an ocean of captured evidence against him, and he had vigorous defense. So my fear, I'm sorry if I ramble, but my fear here is that the International Court of Justice, where Ukraine just appeared a few days ago and Russia didn't even show to say they're committing genocide against us. That's one way, a superpower just not showing. Maybe the ICJ can come back with a default judgment saying, based on what we know and what Ukraine has shown us, we have no problem condemning what Russia has done. But when it comes to criminal liability, what the ICC is supposed to do and what Nuremberg did, we need documents. We need forensic evidence based on crime scenes, on hospitals in Mariupol and so forth. We need eyewitness of perpetrators. It's not enough to say I was walking the streets of Kyiv and all of a sudden a rocket came out of nowhere. That doesn't show which Russian did it. That didn't show that Putin ordered a Russian tactical battalion group to fire at that time. Basically, you need perpetrator evidence Some of it may be found in the one advantage that Nuremberg didn't have, which is cyber evidence. And those of us following this are absolutely fascinated, I think, with what all these groups, Bellingcat and others, are able to do working backwards from people's cell phones and communications. You can track who was where and who talked to whom when. But I don't think it's enough for the criminal conviction of the top people. I have no idea how Putin communicates with his people, famously, and I don't mean to make a disrespectful comparison, but it was always said that President Trump did not use email. Well, I have no idea if President Putin uses email, or does he use written letters, or does he have people come in and sit at opposite ends of the table, hearing what they're told to do, and we need some of them to flip. And all that, you know, we have to think like criminal lawyers, not like international lawyers, to make a criminal case. And I don't know that we can do that yet.
I want to ask you, I was struck though, in the shortly before Russia launched what it claimed was this special military operation, there was a televised cabinet meeting in effect. And Putin called upon individuals to say, "You concur, right? You concur, right?" That was a striking event to me. Do you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, I know what their defense lawyers are going to say if they're ever tried, which is, you know, duress and superior orders. And Nuremberg had a lot of law and teaching on that, which is that the defense of duress is to be read very narrowly in law. And in fact, at Nuremberg, it was deemed that it's not a defense, only it can provide for mitigation of sentence, nothing more. But that's not the standard U.S. or international practice now, which is that, well, if it really meant this person had no choice, no moral choice, perhaps. But we know that can't be true. There are enough, you know, a handful of oligarchs who've defected. There are a handful of journalists who do astonishingly brave things. And there's Navalny, who's, you know, has gone back to Russia voluntarily from being, from at death's door in Germany. We know there are choices that people have, including those people at the other end of the long table, which is to say, count me out, boss. I'm retiring. You know, we frequently talk about this. Many German generals, this was their standard defense. We're following orders. We've taken a special personal oath, as they had to Hitler in the mid-30s. And they said, we had no choice and our honor as an officer and all that. Never mind that they had also taken previous oaths to defend the Weimar Constitution. But it turns out their oaths conveniently allowed them to follow plans that they insisted were wrong, and they knew it and they under-enforced and all the rest. But there were some generals who did take early retirement, in effect, from Hitler. And because they were known to be skeptics, they weren't forced back. And they lived out the war, General Adam and General Beck and others. I mean, even in the Nazi regime, it's possible for someone to say, either explicitly or by calling in sick, whatever you want to call it. There's German words for this of basically inner migration, inner flight. But it's possible. And none of those people at that table, they seemed frightened. They didn't seem brave.
Well, as we reach the top of the hour, this has been a very illuminating discussion. In some ways, perhaps a call to pessimism, but perhaps, I hope, a call to action as well. And I very much appreciate, again, you've given us time from your spring break and teaching. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you and to share this information that we have been broadcasting today and will publish for enduring reference later, to those who share our interest in promoting the rule of law through education. So, Professor Bush, thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Partners in Justice. The Center for American and International Law, founded in 1947, is a Dallas-based nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the quality of justice through the education of tens of thousands of lawyers and law enforcement officials in the United States and throughout the world. Ultimately, our success depends on the leadership and support of our members. We invite you and your organization to learn more about us. Make sure to visit our website, www.cailaw.org, where you can subscribe to the show and learn more about our programs, lectures, and upcoming events. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you simply shared this show with a friend, that would help us out too. Thanks again for listening.